Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, a July 4th event for sky watchers everywhere. Earth farthest from the sun. New discoveries of dark matter. And a virus that makes electricity. Here's a scientist soundbite.
We do have a closest and a farthest point from the sun, and our farthest point from the sun is coming up on July 5th at 3 UTC.
That's Skywatcher Deborah Bird. More with her later, but first, Science News of the Week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
In the last week of June, a wildfire spread down the slopes of the Rocky Mountains and to the city of Colorado Springs. At the time of this recording, 30,000 people have been forced to evacuate and at least 300 homes have been destroyed. We hope the fire will be contained by the time you hear this. To get an update, come to earthsky.org and search for the words Colorado Springs Fire.
Sea Orbiter, a concept from French architect Jacques Rougerie, has completed its industrial design phase. Construction is slated to begin in October of 2012. Its designers say that Sea Orbiter will be a unique type of ship, with half the ship above the waves like an ordinary research vessel, and half below the waves like a submarine. The goal is real-time monitoring of the ocean and its creatures.
To the human eye, the giant planet Saturn doesn't appear as colorful or as distinctly banded as its neighbor planet Jupiter. Yet Saturn has bands traveling east and west across its surface. Scientists see them as jet streams in the atmosphere of this gas giant world. For years, scientists have scratched their heads trying to understand what energy source drives Saturn's jet streams. They thought it might be heat from the sun. But now the verdict is in. It turns out that it's not the sun's heat. It's heat from within Saturn that drives the planet's jet streams.
The Voyager 1 spacecraft has been operating for 34 years and 9 months. Now, after the long journey through our solar system, the craft is believed to be poised at the edge of interstellar space. Voyager 1 is reporting a sharp increase in cosmic rays that may herald its final push out of the heliosphere, the sphere of our sun's influence, and into the realm of the stars. That's our news of the week. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. This week's song of the week is Santa Rosa by The Eastern Sea off their debut full-length album, Plague. The Eastern Sea is out on tour right now, so if they're passing through your town, go out and show them some love.
We'll be right back.
I felt the touch of your skin on my finger. The porous cracks of the bone where the marrow lingered. Somehow the feeling was gone for long, and up from the crypt came a heroin song. And all of the words, they seemed vaguely familiar, like a plagiarized version of a prayer I remember.
We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. Deborah Bird joined us now with news of the global night sky, Earth at its most distant point from the sun. Welcome, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. So Earth's orbit around the sun is not a perfect circle. It's actually what's called an ellipse, which is kind of like a circle that someone sat down on. And so we do have a closest and a farthest point from the sun. And our farthest point from the sun is coming up on July 5th at 3 UTC. So that's the time in London. For us in the central time zone in North America, that'll be July 4th at 10 p.m.
Deborah, how far from the sun are we now?
Well, let me tell you first in kilometers. In kilometers, that would be 152,092,424 kilometers. That's about 94.5 million miles.
And about 6 months earlier, Earth had was at its closest point to the sun, and we were only about 91 million miles. So it doesn't really seem that big a difference, does it?
It's not. And so what I said was that our orbit is not a perfect circle, and it's not, but it's pretty circular. It's more circular, for example, than the orbit of the planet Mars. So our distance from the sun does make a little bit of difference in terms of temperature, but it doesn't really make the big difference in terms of temperature. It's not what causes the seasons on Earth. And you could have guessed that already, because we're farthest from the sun around now when it's summer in the Northern Hemisphere.
So, Deborah, what does cause the seasons?
Well, you know, we all learned this in school, Jorge. It's the Earth is tilted on its axis by 23.5 degrees. And at this time of year, even though we in the Northern Hemisphere are farthest from the sun, our part of Earth is also tilted most toward the sun. So we're receiving the sun's rays most directly. And in fact, it's this tilt of the Earth that gives Earth the four seasons.
Awesome. So any final thoughts on this day of aphelion, Earth's farthest point from the sun?
Well, first of all, that word aphelion, I wanted to say something about that. It comes from a Latin word that has the word helios in it, aphelion. And so it just means far from the sun. So no big mystery there. The other thing is that when Earth is at its farthest from the sun, it's moving at its slowest in orbit. And that's just a law of nature. That's something that goes for all the planets. When they're farthest from the sun, they move slowest in orbit. But the cool effect is that for us in the Northern Hemisphere, it gives a greater, because Earth is moving so slowly in its orbit, it gives a greater number of days between our summer solstice and the autumn equinox, which will take place in September. So actually, our season of summer is a few days longer than our season of winter.
It does feel longer, doesn't it? I mean, it does. I do notice that. It just seems like you can notice that.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you're actually noticing that or something else, but it's actually the physical truth.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. It's time for Weird Science with Ryan Britton. Welcome back.
Oh, glad to be here.
So today you're here with some information about squashing viruses.
That's right.
To generate electricity?
Yep. So imagine having a thin layer of virus on the sole of your shoe and generating a bit of electricity as you walk. That's what scientists at the United States Department of Energy, Berkeley National Laboratory, have come up with.
So that's the future of energy? Sounds pretty gross.
Yeah. Well, scientists, what they did was they took a harmless virus. This is a virus that only attacks bacteria, and sandwiched it between two layers of film, and they basically built a little bitty generator. It looks a lot like two slides of a microscope. Then they tapped on this electrode, this generator, and created pressure intermittently. Tap, 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 if you will. And this actually creates what's called piezoelectricity. And this was enough to power up a small LCD display. So piezoelectricity is a phenomenon that they're taking advantage of. And this happens when certain materials, in this case, the material is the virus, is stressed by the tapping or squishing of it created by the tapping. And so from this stress, the virus emits a current of electricity. It's just a bit of electricity, about a quarter of the voltage of a AAA battery.
That's quite a bit for a little virus.
Yeah, and it's a great start. I mean, a lot of work needs to be done in terms of upping the electricity, if you will. But yeah, more research is on the way.
I guess in thinking about the cell phones and all the icky germs on them, maybe a scientist will figure out a way to tap into those germs and get some power out of them.
There you go. Well, you can find out the beginnings of this type of research at biosciencetechnology.com. And there's also information and a video at the Berkeley Lab where this research is being done. And you can see that on the web at newscenter.lbl.gov.
Cool. Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
Don't stop now. It's hard for me to figure out the way you move. It's like this every afternoon when the day is done and you're standing in the summer sun. It's almost gone. So for now I can't pretend to know the words and sing along.
Sky, we interview the world's top scientists. Dark matter is a mystery of science. Stars at the outskirts of spiral galaxies orbit much faster than the laws of physics predict. Some unseen mass must be there, say scientists, a halo surrounding a spiral galaxy like our Milky Way, and they call that dark matter. Astrophysicist Sukanya Chakrabarty of Florida Atlantic University has developed a new way to map dark matter, looking at the ripples made by this dark matter in the outer gas disks of spiral galaxies. Dr. Chakrabarty explained her findings in this interview at the 219th meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Austin, Texas. Dr. Chakrabarty, welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us about the results of your study that looked at mapping dark matter in nearby spiral galaxies. What did you find out?
What I found in this study is that the ripples in the outer gas disks of galaxies act as a mirror of the depth of the dark matter potential well. So if the potential well is very steep, the kind of disturbances that form in the outer gas disk are very tightly wrapped. If the potential well is very shallow, the disturbances that form are more loosely wrapped. So by looking at the kind of structures that form in the outer gas disks of galaxies, we can get a handle on the underlying dark matter density distribution. So basically, the observational result that I'm analyzing are the atomic hydrogen maps. So these are maps of the cold gas on the outskirts of galaxies.
Okay, so I guess at the outer disk of this nearby galaxy that you looked at, that's where it is interacting with other galaxies, is that right?
Right, right. So I analyzed specifically the Whirlpool Galaxy. It's also known as M51. It has a very dramatic arm that extends out to very large distances. And that arm is the product of a merger, of a tidal interaction with its own satellite. So in an earlier paper, we showed that by looking at the strength of the disturbances, this is work that I presented at last year's WAS press conference. I showed with a number of collaborators that by looking at the strength of the disturbances, we could figure out how massive the dwarf galaxy is that produced the structures that we see in the outer gas disk, and also where it is in radius and azimuth. So in principle, this gives you a means of hunting for dark matter-dominated dwarf galaxies. And this is one of the problems we now face in modern cosmology. There's something called the missing satellites problem, where theorists expected to see many more galactic satellites than are actually observed in the local neighborhood. So we wanted to come up with a method that allows you to find galactic satellites, dark matter-dominated dwarf galaxies, from analysis of their gravitational effects on other bodies without requiring knowledge of their stellar light, because many of these things are very dim. They're very dark matter dominated, so they don't have a lot of optical light. So we wanted to figure out a way of you know, hunting for them without needing to see their stellar light. So this is actually quite similar to the way Neptune was discovered in the 1840s. So in the 1840s, Le Verrier analyzed disturbances in the orbits of Uranus, and he made the hypothesis that they were due to a yet unseen planet. And he was able to figure out the azimuth of that planet, now known as Neptune, to within a degree. So that's the first example of the discovery of an essentially dark object from analysis of its effects, its gravitational effects on another body, and it's in a similar spirit to the work that we're trying to do.
Just to back up a second, please describe for us, what is dark matter?
Right. So one of the most of the mass in galaxies is dark. And this was observationally inferred on galactic scales back in the 70s. So in the 70s, what we found were that when you looked at the rotation curves of galaxies, when you looked at the circular speed in galaxies, it continued to be flat out to large distances. And these distances were large compared to the region where you saw the stars. Okay, and from Newtonian gravity, you expect the circular speed to fall. We had expected the circular speed to fall off at large distances where we didn't see the stars. But it continued to be flat out to very large distances that are, you know, distances that are large compared to the region where we saw emission from the stars. So it was then inferred that there is an unseen dark component that is producing these flat rotation curves. So dark matter is dark because it doesn't emit any electromagnetic radiation, but it is massive. So that means that it will interact gravitationally with whatever else, right? So that's the main thing that we're taking advantage of here. It's the fact that we can study its gravitational signatures on a very highly responsive thing, and that's the cold gas. The cold gas is a great tracer because it's very responsive. So it's basically like, you know, dropping pebbles into a pond and looking at the ripples in the pond and trying to figure out how massive was the pebble. You know, if you sort of understood the physics of that well enough, you might be able to do it, even if you didn't see the pebble fall in.
Tell us about this step towards actually being able to put it on a map and see what it looks like.
So that's exactly what we're trying to, you know, do here, to map it. And by mapping it, you know, that means to figure out, you know, not just it has some total mass, but to figure out, you know, how much of it is in the central regions, how much of it in the outer regions, and so forth, to actually create a map of it, you know, like you were trying to create a map of the world or something like that. So that's the hope, is that we can actually map dark matter by looking at something that that we can see. The hunt for dark matter, as I said earlier, has a lot in common with the hunt for planets back in the 1800s. So there's a lot of potential to understand dark matter from its effects on other things, from its gravitational effects on other things. I think that's a very promising thing. It's very similar in spirit to the way Neptune was discovered. It's a kind of indirect means of hunting for this thing that we can't see.
You've been listening to astrophysicist Sukanya Chakrabarty. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at Earth Sky Studio B in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Eastern Sea, Sleep Good, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt you. What you don't know won't hurt you.